to that, and is obviously completely a crock. It's not important at all, because no matter what, we're going to get the same person in power. I mean, if Kerry wins or Bush wins, they're going to be, you know, the war in Iraq is going to continue. The war in Afghanistan.
What can people do to fight the war in Iraq, to fight the occupation?
Well, I think that not only I think there needs to be a lot more like taking. I know this seems like really simple, but it's not so simple. There should be a literature table, and even though how dangerous it is to do that on downtown, I know it's like you're risking your ass to try to do this, but to go into public areas with literature against the war and try, I think there should be a lot more direct action. For instance, you guys have like a weapons facility near you. There could be a lot more blockades of that weapons facility. There could be, more occupations of government buildings, that kind of thing. It's an emergency, and Americans are somehow not seeing that it's an emergency, because the whole rest of the world is depending on us. Well, actually, most people just assume that everybody in America, the people that I've met, and were surprised that there were anti-war people in America and thought that we somehow all loved George Bush and that we somehow loved, they didn't really get that how stupid America is exactly. But we need to be trying to not only have information about what's really going on in the world, but trying to get more mainstream people to join us in doing disruptive activities again. Things like organizing strikes, blockades, that kind of thing, as well as educational things, showing documentaries and videos about what's happening. We should be talking about the coup in Haiti. Why is the U.S. overthrowing Aristide again? Why is the U.S. trying to overthrow the government of Venezuela? Why does the U.S. believe that it has the right to determine outcomes around the world? In Europe, the poverty is increasing dramatically in Europe, and it's due to these globalization of the economy and this phony war on terrorism nonsense, where they're doing anti-terrorist laws in all the countries. There's this severe right-wing turn of events, like in Holland, there's all kinds of very conservative laws that are being passed by the conservative government there. Neo-Nazis are gaining power all over the world. There's like Nazi graffiti everywhere in Europe and even in Turkey. It's really intense. But at the same time, our governments are supporting that kind of activity. That's really, really outrageous, and it needs to stop.
So when can people hear you in the flesh if they want to hear more of this vicious appeals?
People should go to the foodnotbombs.net website and click on the tour link, and then that'll give an approximate idea of when I will be in the Bay Area. And I think that's sometime in late May.
And that's where the Drop Bush Not Bombs campaign?
Yeah, the Drop Bush Not Bombs tour.
Well, what I say is you got to dump Bushism as well as Bush. That's the primary issue, not Bush.
Yeah,
Bushism,
Yeah, and the whole, it is very, very frightening what is going on in every area of the world. I found really fascinating, for instance, everybody's appealing to, it's like in every country, Israel, Turkey, everywhere in Europe, they're saying that, the United States is the greatest threat to world security, and that it's up to the people in the United States to overthrow their government and to bring the world to safety,
That's why we're all supporting President Kerry.
Yeah, right.
We're talking with Keith McHenry here of Food Not Bombs from Tucson, Arizona. Keith, that pretty much wraps it up, unless you want to conclude with something.
Vote for me.
Hey, write in Keith McHenry.
Right, whatever. Yeah. So, yeah, join your local Food Not Bombs group and or any other direct action organization and try to disrupt capitalism as we know it today.
And the number, of course, to call the local Food Not Bombs is 831-425-3345, 831-425-3345. And if you want to reach Keith and maybe get
one last
with money, this stuff, give him, you know, talk to him about it, what's the email address?
Oh, well, you can email me at keith@foodnotbombs.net. And also, there's going to be a huge protest in New York City the last week of August, and there's a Food Not Bombs gathering there, a world gathering, where Food Not Bombs people from all over the world are going to be talking about strategy, sharing information on how they organize in their community, and they'll be, and then we'll be doing direct action and protesting in, in New York City against the Republican National Convention. There's also another series of actions against the Democrats in Boston during the Democratic Presidential National Convention. That's in July.
Okay, maybe we can get updates when those dates get closer. Keith, thank you for taking an hour and about an hour to run through this stuff with us. And
There you go.
All right, man.
Okay.
All right.
Fly often.
Food, not bombs.
Great. Bye.
Bye-bye. And that was Keith McHenry, co-founder of Food Not Bombs from Tucson, Arizona. This is Robert Norris. You're tuned to Free Radio, 96.3 FM, 101.1 FM. And www.freakradio.org if you're listening on the net. This show runs until 1 o'clock. That was an interview directly online, or I should say on the phone. We don't have the facility to bring in other phone calls at that time, but we now have open lines in case you want to comment on anything you've heard or raise any issues. 427-3772, 427-3772 is the number to call if you'd like to talk about any of this stuff. And while I'm waiting for the flood of calls to come in, let's hear a little more of Ann Feeney. And that was, of course, National Healthcare Now, and Feeney from the album Look to the Left. I'm looking now at the Counterpunch website, kind of interested in the latest Kerry boom. And I recommend people, for if they want to get a contrasting view of Kerry, even of Kucinich, from the left, you might go to Counterpunch, www.counterpunch.org. Here's a column by Alexander Cockburn, or Coburn, depending on how you pronounce it, and Jeffrey St. Clair. February 11th, campaign diary. Hail Kerry, senator facing both ways. Farewell Clark, dude, where's my candidate? We await Michael Moore's concession speech after his hero, General Wesley Clark, tasted the ashes of defeat in Tennessee and Virginia and sensibly threw in the towel. If Dean was the hero of the dot-coms, Clark was a creation of the Arkansas-Hollywood axis embodied in the Clinton-era stage managers such as Harry and Linda Thomason, Mary Steenburgen, and Ted Danson. It was supposed to be the Man from Hope, the sequel, this time with a genuine military officer rather than Bill the Draft Dodger. The rollout for the Clark campaign was Linda Thomason's native son, alluding to Clark's early years in Little Rock. At Clark's elbow was Bruce Lindsay, former law partner of Bill Clinton, and later his White House counsel. Lindsay put it about that Clark's mission was to stop the meteoric surge of Howard Dean, and Clark told reporters the Clintons had urged to get into the race. In the weeks before the Iowa caucus, Clark was the only Democratic candidate who was able to get Clinton to appear in a campaign commercial. Representative Rahm Emanuel, former Clinton White House staffer, declared for Clark. Further glitzy support came from the Detroit-Hollywood axis of Michael Moore and Madonna, who in the wake of her hero's withdrawal has now said she's moving to France. Additional liberal backing came from the New York Review of Books, which ran an entire chapter of Clark's unreadable campaign bio. Tottering under the burdens of such sponsorship, Clark was soon sprawling in a heap of contradictions. He had supported the attack on Iraq, but now he opposed it. The war was launched under fraudulent pretenses, but yes, he had agreed with Bush and Rumsfeld about the menace of Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction. It wasn't long before his campaign was dead in the water, as ordinary voters couldn't figure out what Clark was all about. Virginia was meant to be his big state, and he didn't break into double figures. Moral: get Bill Clinton or Al Gore throwing you their support, and you sink like a stone to the bottom. At least Gore's support of Dean was an honest bet on a man Gore thought was the likely winner and a good opponent to put up against Bush. As always, the Clintons were playing a selfish game. For them, Clark's function was to merely stop Dean, thus preserving their power within the National Democratic Committee. Day after day, Clinton mafiosi like McAuliffe, Carville, and Begala worked the phones and the talk shows deriding Dean, and their onslaught was very effective. Dean made his own mistakes and spent much of his $40 million foolishly on lousy campaign ads, but it's clear that in Iowa and New Hampshire, he was up against the Democratic Party machine and lacked the experienced operators who might have saved the day. It was the party machine that pulled it out for Kerry, and once Kerry had got those two crucial victories, the overwhelming eagerness of Democratic voters to anoint an uncontested champion to go up against Bush carried him forward. Across the last 30 years, it's hard to think of a Democratic candidate seemingly assured of his party's nomination who has had less of a baptism of sewage in the primaries than Senator John Kerry. Normally, a front-running candidate can expect a roughing up from his sparring partners, but Dean drew all the fire, with Clark as prime diversion and Kucinich as the small white hope of the progressive crowd. So Kerry's dismal record has been allowed to remain in decorous seclusion. Most Democrats consider Kerry's record as irrelevant and view those with the bad taste to excavate it as active subverters of a righteous cause. But Karl Rove, Bush's political commissar, will not be so polite. Kerry reminds us of no one so much as Mr. Facing Both Ways in Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress. Unlike Bush, who sensibly took a vacation from the perils of conflict in the National Guard, Kerry enlisted for combat in Vietnam and shuttled up and down the Mekong River, commanding a swift boat deployed for the sort of counterinsurgency missions that had Kerry's former senatorial colleague, Bob Kerry of Nebraska, slitting the throats of Vietnamese villagers. Kerry returned to the U.S., thrust himself forward as a leader of the anti-war movement, but made a point of distancing himself from Vietnam veterans against the war. Like Clinton trying to figure out how to dodge the draft respectably, Kerry was zealous to preserve his political viability within the system. The agenda of some of the folks within the veterans movement ultimately became confused and went way beyond trying to end the war, Kerry later told the Boston Phoenix. There was a lot of rhetoric about every social ill and evil there was. The media got the point. Morley Safer of CBS applauded Kerry as, quote, a veteran whose articulate call to reason rather than anarchy seemed to bridge the gap between Abby Hoffman and Mr. Agnew's so-called silent majority. From Abby to Agnew. Now, there's a leap. A leap. Distaste for anarchy notwithstanding, when the WAW forced a Senate hearing, because the Vietnam Veterans Against the War forced a Senate hearing on the war, Kerry pushed himself to the front to deliver the high-profile testimony before the TV cameras, and later at a vets demonstration at the White House, similarly took advantage of the heavily covered event to join other vets in throwing war medals over the White House fence. The ones tossed by Kerry actually belonged to someone else, thus permitting the prudent Kerry to preserve his own for later proud display in his various offices and for their ultimate deployment as blazing reproaches to Bush. Like many a political aspirant to buttress viability, Kerry, the gap bridger, then became a prosecutor in Middlesex County, then lieutenant governor in 1982 in the regime of governor. Well, you can search high and low on Kerry's campaign bio, but you will find it difficult to detect the name of Michael Dukakis. Kerry was elected to the U.S. Senate in 1984. In his first term, Kerry ventured onto some interesting and politically perilous terrain, with hearings into the scandal-ridden CIA-linked bank BCI and into the arms for cocaine-contra scandals in Central America. In the end, he lost his nerve, and the hearings ultimately floundered to an inconclusive close. It was the last spark of vigor in a senatorial career of singular blandness and timidity. Already in the 1980s, this supposed Massachusetts liberal, always an oversold species, supported the Graham-Rudman Deficit Reduction Act, a dagger in the heart of social programs. Kerry later renewed his commitment to the war on the poor by backing Clinton's successful onslaught on aid to poor mothers and their children, and more recently still voted for Bush's tax cuts. In the Clinton years, Kerry positioned himself as the one questioning the efficacy of affirmative action. When the Reagan administration launched the full might of U.S. power against the island of Grenada, population 80,000, in 1983, Kerry criticized this imperial excursion. These days, with his medals out of the closet, he says, quote, I was basically supportive. I never publicly opposed it. When the first Gulf War was at the start of the 1990s, with the first Gulf War, Kerry changed positions so rapidly his staff grew dizzy with the effort of keeping up with their boss's gyrations. He finally voted against authorizing the war, but almost immediately issued a press release supporting the invasion. The 2003 war finds Kerry voting with the Bush administration, only to cast himself in the early primary season as the opponent. Kerry voted for Clinton's crime bill and for Clinton's counterterrorism and effective death penalty act, which set the template for Bush's Patriot Act, which Kerry, who loses no opportunity to belittle the stupid John Ashcroft, also saw fit to support the Patriot Act. Kerry has indulged himself in some dutiful populist rhetoric against big oil, the drug companies, the HMOs, and, quote, the influence peddlers. Given his overall record, these burbles are not to be taken seriously as anything beyond campaign insurance against the occasional populist talk of John Edwards, his sometime rival, on the primary trail. The Kerry campaign has the enduring benefit of the vast fortune of Mrs. Kerry, the former Teresa Hines, the tumultuous child of Portuguese Empire. Mrs. Kerry can use her influence to run issue ads. Her interest in environmental issues has been mostly expressed through her Hines Foundation, whose board until very recently was adorned by that hero of free market enviros, Ken Lay of Enron. The Hines Foundation put Ken Lay in charge of their global warming initiative. When Enron went belly up, the foundation stuck by their man. Quote, whatever troubles he had at Enron, Ken Lay had a good reputation in the environmental community for being a businessman who is environmentally sensitive. When someone does wrong in one past of their life, it doesn't mean they can't do good in another part of their life. It's the kind of sublime indifference to the messy realities of politics and life that is now inspiring Democrats to rally behind Kerry under the vacant banner, Anybody But Bush. That's a story on the Counterpunch website by Alexander Coburn and Jeffrey St. Clair, Campaign Diary, Hail Kerry, Senator Facing Both Ways, February 11th. You can check it out. Lots of interesting stories on that website. Could come to your own conclusion about the merits or lack thereof. Here's another story by Michael Colby, Bush versus Kerry, the Power Elite's Dream Ballot, but looks like we got a caller here. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, it's Julia Winograd.
Oh, Julia. Wow. Yes, Julia. Let me introduce you, Julia. I I wasn't sure when you were going to call in. It's good to have you.
Yeah, Becky called me.
Yeah. Julia, you're of course, are a prolific poet who lives in Berkeley, California, and you've written, what, 43, 44, or is it 45 books?
I think it's 47 by now, but I'm not sure myself.
Wow. And I know that you are also, you live humbly in a little room with the rent going up on University Avenue.
Yeah.
In downtown Berkeley. And usually you turn out a book a year, but you're struggling with some health problems now, right?
Yeah, I had a cataract operation. And you really can't put a book together when you have a cataract operation. I could read you a poem about that and then some street poems.
It sounds like the cataract operation was successful.
Yes, I can now see.
Excellent. Sure, let's start with some poems. I've loved your poetry for years, and I know you. I've really appreciated your previous readings on the air, as well as your permission to publish your stuff in,
anytime.
In and around the area. Yeah, go ahead.
After my cataract operation, two eyes make a me. I still sleep with an eye patch and eye drops four times a day, but today I'll go out for the first time since the operation and I'll look at you with both eyes. It's like kissing you on both cheeks at some royal ceremony where a bottle of sunlight breaks on a battleship. My eyes get drunk on world and behave badly. I stare at strangers like a child, and yes, it's rude to stare, but my eyes make love to your face because it's not a blur. A chorus of angels praise each worry line and freckle dust. Two eyes make a me, and I can't stop looking. You walk in blessing because I see you. I don't want to know your name, and it doesn't matter if I ever see you again. My eyes stroke all the colors of a faded brick residential hotel. Red, brown, pink, brown, orange dust, purple chip. My eyes kiss every crack in the pavement as if they were my dead mother's ribs and I could bring her back. I stop for a stoplight and don't want to leave its side. It was so tall and never doubted, like cowboys in the movies. When the stoplight looks at me, it makes me blush. Two eyes make a me. I'll go out and make love to barking dogs, wailing police cars, dead tires covered with damp nasturtiums and vacant lots, thrown out wooden kitchen chairs with missing legs and people. Because I never saw them before and I can't get enough. They wouldn't believe how beautiful they are. Would they have to lose an eye to see themselves?
Wow. Can't really follow that with any comments.
Okay.
I got another one for you?
Oh, yeah, I got a batch.
Let's hear some more.
I got taken to the Chagall show, and when I came back, I wrote this. It's called Telegraph Avenue After Seeing the Chagall Show.
Uh-huh.
Chagall, how would you paint our streets? The three punk boys not old enough to drink, spare changing for beer for their mascot, Hank the Rooster, who could drink from a can and always drank first. Even the sorority blondes would stop to ruffle Hank's feathers while the boys sat ankle-eye level, not quite brave enough to whistle, until the day Hank betrayed them all and laid an egg. And the next day they were gone. Chagall, would you set that egg like the sun in your Ferris wheel, whirling blue sky, with the three boys breaking out of it and climbing down, hanging on for dear life, leather-clad, yokes splattering their hair, arm over arm to your happy goats with a village streaming between their legs? Would that transvestite rooster lead the sacred marriage of a languid, green-veiled tree with a woman's face and lovers' hearts and gang graffiti knife-carved into her bark like the scrolls of the law to a chipped stone lamppost lighting the whole picture so old they built the street around him, but not too old for love? Our city took away our bus benches recently because they were slept on at night. Would you help all those white-haired little old ladies with bags of groceries and kitty litter whose ankles hurt with arthritis or lean on a cane? Would you paint them all wings, red, yellow, green, brightest traffic lights to hover half a foot over the sidewalk and peer down the street over trucks blocking the view to see if their bus is coming yet? They'll keep your wings clean if they keep their thrift store rose print dresses. Chagall, after a one football game, paint revelers at a beer and pizza bar, red-faced, gasping with laughter, clanking thick glasses surrounded by all the leaping colors of a shout while pepperoni pizzas spin round their heads like halos they jump at and miss. But as long as no one missed the ball, their thick, soggy fingers overflow with moonlight. One of your water sellers with a heavy stick across his shoulder brings full pails of beer to their table and a purple horse leaps out the window, snorting. You musicians could play on our streets. King David's crown is made of shiny quarters, crazy glued together. Even the black lace vampire goth girls with silver skeleton earrings stop at his much-fingered harp and slowly blush through their death-white makeup. King David's smile and harp can turn any woman into a woman. And it will get him in trouble here, too. Our drunks see roofs dancing, roads curving into the sky with angels leaning over to tickle their red-veined noses till they sneeze. If they get away from the cops, some of the drunks pass out in your pictures and never know the difference. Chagall paint us home till even the textbooks under a student's arm are full of kisses, warm, wild kisses that leap into his mouth and drag him bewildered into your bursting flowers the moment he opens a page. And some more directly street ones.
Mm-hmm.
Spare changers. The passing crowd shrugs off their eyes like soggy spitballs. A grunge tribe with low-slung belts down to the crack in their butts share a bag of day-old donuts in the rain. A wheelchair veteran with ghost fires licking at his wheels, empty paper cups on mock fishing poles. Their chants aren't words anymore. Spare change is verbal dandruff that must be brushed away. What would a girl say if a new shirt is covered with begging dandruff? Not even cruelly. Sometimes I wish it were. The passing crowd hates the other football team or politicians, but they don't hate what doesn't exist. The shopping cart pushed by a skinny screen piled high with junk and topped with a toy pink plastic phone isn't there. The lovers leaning into each other in a winter doorway aren't there. The mother aiming her crying child at the passing crowd isn't there. Spare changers spend their days being erased like typos, saying, I am so alive, sort of, is hard, mind-breaking work. The goth girls pray at being vampires, but it's the spare changers who cast no reflections because no one wants to see. If the one of them has a small fuzzy puppy, the puppy gets a smile. The passing crowd feels guilty enough to people they love. There's no room to feel guilty about strangers. Who has the time? It's going to take magic. I just finished a children's story with a cloak of invisibility, and what the world needs now is the exact opposite. So we see what we look at. Where do we get visibility cloaks?
Beautiful.
Okay.
On, more.
Okay. Anniversary party at People's Park. Drummers on stage, circles of people whirling rags and feathers. We're a tribe. We're on the cover of National Geographic, where Native women carry baskets on their heads, bare breasts swaying. We don't have any baskets. We've got some basket cases, and a few girls shrug their shirts off while freckles pour down from the hot sky like the Skittles ad. Taste the rainbow. A bottle of red wine goes around a circle of reddening faces, brighter than blood. Broken teeth grin, beer cans blossom. Enough spills for our thirsty ghosts. Lovers' hands get big and blurry. We're a tribe. We move in mystic circles, like the drunk said when the cop told him to walk a straight line. Damp grass licks our bare feet like a puppy's tongue. Half the people here can't do anything but magic, and magic dissolves in the rain. It rained yesterday, it will rain tomorrow, but today we're having a party in the middle of a hostile donut. The thing about the park is you can't just go there unless the park comes out to meet you. Today it has. We're a tribe. In spite of a sound system from hell, we're using the music to climb ourselves, like dancing up a rusty fire escape to steal the fire, just in case cops circle the block as it gets darker. We're at the center of the jungle. People on the street with nowhere to go for Thanksgiving. Is it too late to do a Thanksgiving poem?
I think not. Go ahead.
Ghost turkeys with candied yams and two kinds of stuffing and cranberry sauce and smiling ghost families are everywhere at the bottom of a bottle of wild turkey, at the laundromat, in shadow doorways where linen napkins wipe up street people like spilled gravy. A ghost turkey big as a blimp rules the sky, pushing aside sun and moon and shining down radioactive smiles, families who will never be glad to see street people again. The ghost turkey blimp is so bad, brave men would rather face a gang, or angry cops, or even a furious girlfriend who just found a letter. Long lines of charity dinners serve food on aluminum trays, but not on grandmother's special dishes at a huge dining table, usually covered with books and toy trains. Being nine again and staring untrustingly at giggling second cousins and everyone starched and overdressed. Thanksgiving on the street gets so bad, occasional fights try to change the subject. It doesn't work. The ghost turkey eats street people like corn kernels. The ghost turkey spreads its wings and flies off with the world.
Thanks.
Okay.
Keep going. Don't stop unless you've got more to give us.
Oh, I got more.
All right.
This one's kind of weird. Night. In the night city, you can't avoid the void, the boiling void. Or you're looking for white lines on a mirror, or driving a meat truck chasing the white line, or being chased by muggers and monsters in the mirror, or letting club music vibrate loud enough to drown out your dead mother who never stops talking. The dark rubs open-mouthed against your skin. You can't wash it off. You can't avoid the void. Saints are stretched on the wheels of cars. When they die, they lean between flashing light bulbs on a mission cross and spit down on the drunks. Don't look up. On the strip, neon signs promise naked girls, naked boys, naked parking meters, naked fire hydrants, naked fires. But you drank up the night and the night gulped you down, and you're afraid to touch your face in case it isn't there. You can't avoid the void. Dead-end streets come back to life when you're not looking and dance with the void. You can fall in all directions. Half-eaten men poke through garbage bins for thrown-out half-eaten food. There's a newspaper whose pages are spare changer scrawled cardboard signs. Only the void reads it, but you can't avoid the void. By the hour, hotel rooms are full of squealing, hungry mattresses. Captain John Smith is still looking for a new world between the next pair of high heels. But you can drown on land while the regulation Bible rattles in a closed bureau drawer. You can't avoid the void. In the 24-hour donut shop, donuts are glazed as the girl's eyes and almost as old. And there's a guy trying to convince his coffee cup that, well, maybe at first if you didn't understand, but really he won, really. He gets so loud the counterman glances at him once till he shuts up, slumped over the coffee. He still isn't drinking. Even the invisible people are selling pills. You can't avoid the void. Crazies pile everything into stolen shopping carts. A pink toy telephone to call the CIA and report the dead children who tease them. A blanket, a smashed lamp, and pieces of sky cut out with a broken beer bottle, and that's what happened to the ozone layer. You can't avoid the void, the boiling void. And when you get too close, it whispers your name. Sometimes it sings. It sings so sweet. Maybe two more?
Please.
Street dancer. Saw this guy. Black, strong, bare to the waist, bald, bare feet on burning summer sidewalk. Sweat steams off muscles, rippling so slow. It's much harder to move that slow. Scuttle and bounce around him, dueling stereo boxes, an escaped high school class boiling out of a bus, a baby telling the world his diaper needs changing, an old lady threatening to call the cops on an ATM machine, the smash of grinding ice for cool drinks. The dancer's in the center, but he's not in the center of this. His legs leap over centuries. He hasn't lost his rib yet. Another one out of his meds at the end of the month, someone shrugs. No, look, a friend at the coffee house tells me. There's a straight line going up the center of his body. He dances around it, but it never moves. He may be crazy, but he's had some training. A slow hand, fingers spread, pushes hard against the air. Does the air push back? Heavy slabs closing in? The dancer bends back, leaps forward, face clenched as his muscles, a dance violent as chess. People walk around him, talking to each other, too nervous to take his picture. No music, none needed. I saw a foreign documentary of Easter worshippers proving their faith by walking on hot coals. His dance is like that, but his religion is him. It's Saturday afternoon. People walk dogs, pretty girls walk belly buttons, children shout and drip strawberry ice cream. Not for him. He sees an empty plane going on forever. He is the darkness brooding on the face of the waters. He has to dance a world. Mm-hmm. And I guess this is my Christmas one. It's called San Francisco Goes to Pray.
Okay.
I'll end with this. When a shopping cart people with coins on their eyes steal names of dead poets off of street signs and dance with them all night, because you've got to dance with something. City, she wakes next morning, her slim ankles aching and her hair all a tangle. When her briefcase people read contracts instead of graffiti on the company bathroom walls, on the other side of town they dress a slum baby girl only in daddy's pink slips from all daddy's lost jobs. And City, she wears bright colors and sleeky black to her nightclubs, but she never wears pink. When her cabbies yell at her traffic, when her clouds yell at her traffic, when her best dress made of steam coming from a manhole grating in the street and Playboy centerfold sewn over her breasts tears like paper crumbling in her hands, when it's too much, City, she goes to pray. There's this place, not on a map. The stained glass windows of a green and joyful land are made of broken beer bottles and red from a wine bottle for the apple. Junky needles outline the star. Biker angels play with the child, grinning snaggletooth with shiny chains and leather wings. But the three kings were mugged, crowns and gifts stolen, left to climb out of a ditch. They look so silly. City, she always smiles. At the pulpit, a speed freak waves his arms. He's lost his voice, but he can't stop. Words grow out of his mouth like dead newspapers. City, she kneels and cradles her restless face in her long fingers. But she don't listen. Nobody does. City, she wears bright lipstick kisses and her fingers like rings. She always leaves the kiss wriggling in the poor box. There's a naked choir dressed in slaps and bruises moaning, "No, no, please stop." Funeral lilies grow between their thighs. A gargoyle organist who's almost human except he needs dusting leads the choir. City, she bows her head. Such beautiful music. Just before leaving, City, she dips her fingers in the mirror on the altar and puts a shine back in her eyes. City, she breathes in the blues like incense, curses a candle, and lights the darkness like every lover.
I think I remember that one. You may have read that to me before. That's great.
Did I read it on the air? I hope not.
No, if you did, it's worth a second reading.
Oh, okay.
It sure is. Anything else you want to add to that? Any other poems you want to bring out?
Well, this isn't particularly street, but it's my Valentine poem.
Now, that sounds apropos.
It's called Battlefield.
Okay.
When the living have gone on to the next hill or set up camp or whatever the living do, a blonde young girl with aching breasts and a long bare knife steps barefoot through the battlefield. Loose shimmering hair down to her hips catches all the light going away. Twisted expert fingers and mad eyes, cold as jewels. The dying soldiers told stories about her around campfires, but they never believed them before. Once she was human, made fresh bread, and when she carried a rough clay jug of water on her shoulder, she knew the village boys watched her out of half-shut eyes. Then she fell in love with a monster deep in a mountain cave. There's no light, only her bruises reflect his furious shape. But she stopped thinking centuries ago. Armies change uniforms and languages over time. She doesn't care. After the battle, she brings her knife and precisely cuts out hearts from the dead and the dying. Muscles don't delay her, her ribs distract. Her lover likes them best, still warm. She brings the monster bloody valentines piled high in her skirt and dripping down her legs for him to lick. Because she loves him, and she'll always love him, and soldiers always die.
Right. We've been listening to Julia Vinograd, whose poetry is legendary in Berkeley. How do we get a few of these legends in our own homes and these relatively inexpensive books? I guess you also have CDs and other tapes.
Yeah, the books are $5. The CDs are $15. You can get the books either for me or at Cody's, Moe's, Shakespeare's. I think City Lights has some.
Mm-hmm. And if you're in Santa Cruz and you can't get up to Berkeley, those are all stores in Berkeley, you can get in touch with me on the Huff line, 423-HUFF. I think I still have some copies of some of your recent works, which I will sell for you and pass on the proceeds to you, Julia.
People can also write me and order them.
Okay. Cut out the middleman.
Yeah. You know, like I said, the books are $5, and it's an extra $1 for postage. And my address is 1630 University Avenue, number 34, Berkeley, 94703.
1630 University Avenue, number 34, 94703?
Yeah, Berkeley.
Julia Vinograd, V-I-N-O-G-R-A-D.
Yes.
Anything you might want to say, Julia, about how the scene is for poets in Berkeley these days? Are you still, are you in touch with other poets up there?
Yeah, they started having readings upstairs at the Met every Thursday. That's at the Mediterranean Cafe.
It's on Telegraph and Haste, right?
And and there are a couple of other poetry readings. Quality varies depending on who's reading, that kind of thing.
Is the climate friendlier to poets than it was a few years ago? I mean, say 10 or 15 years ago, or is it getting worse? Is it getting harder up there? What's happening?
Oh, all kinds of things are getting harder. Mm-hmm. There's talk about closing down the Quarter Meal.
And explain what the Quarter Meal is for folks.
A place where you can pay a quarter and get a meal a day.
And that's been an institution in Berkeley for, what, 30 years?
At least.
Mm-hmm.
They may just cut it back to 3 days a week. But there's also talk about closing it entirely. They're running short of money.
Well, I know that there's talk in Santa Monica of closing down food servings in parks, mainly because of the gentrification, sort of anti-Food Not Bombs type attitude.
Yeah, there's a lot of that.
Mm-hmm. Any new updates on People's Park?
The park poem I read you, I wrote at the last anniversary. It's the cops don't bother it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Things are sort of tighter and bleaker here than they've been for a while. A lot of services are getting cut.
And how about folks who are just trying to sleep at night? Are they suffering the usual harassment from police? Or?
Oh, yes.
So there's no amnesty for people who have no choice but to be outdoors?
No, it's... If anything, it's worse.
Mm-hmm. In spite of your new liberal mayor, Tom Bates?
It's not his fault. He's probably okay. But programs get cut when there's no money, and Arnie sort of enthusiastically cuts the poor programs.
Governor Schwarzenegger.
Yes. He kind of overrides anything that a mere mayor can do.
Well, the mere mayor does control the local police, theoretically, and has access to changing the municipal codes, which the local police enforce. So, in theory, he could direct the police, given the shelter emergency, not to arrest people for, say, simply sleeping.
Yeah. The governor, on the other hand, can close things down.
Well, yeah, the governor can cut the funding, and there are some state laws the governor, well, through the legislature, has some impact on. But it's local police, for example, that enforce, 647J, the anti-lodging law that the Berkeley City Council ruled several years ago after much activist pressure should be the lowest priority of enforcement and enforced only after, I think, a complaint and two warnings, or a warning and two complaints, I'm not sure which.
Yeah, I don't think that many people get arrested but they get tickets, you know, expensive tickets that nobody can pay.
Which leads to an arrest if you don't pay or go to court.
And I think the idea is that if you don't pay or go to court, you leave town so you won't get arrested.
That's the idea.
That's sort of what they did during the Depression.
Yeah, well, it's a way of making sure that we have only the more self-sufficient kinds of citizens. Are you likely to keep your lodging yourself? I know some people around here are threatened with losing their housing.
Well, you know, it's complicated. Everything is in negotiation and probably will be for a while. I certainly hope I can. I couldn't find another place. The only place anybody can afford are the places they're already in.
Mm-hmm. You have kind of the remnants of rent control in Berkeley, right?
Yeah. The main loophole that I'm in trouble with at the moment is capital improvements. The new landlords want to capitally improve things and then pass on the cost to the tenants. And, of course, nobody could afford it, and we don't want it. I mean, we don't want a security parking lot would only be of use to any yuppies, and it would keep out visitors anyway. Some of us want visitors.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is the rent control board become more conservative?
No. They just can't do anything about things like capital improvements.
Because that's state
law.
It's
a loophole.
Yeah.
If you have landlords with very, very good expensive lawyers, and then just a tenant...
Well, at least in Berkeley you have, I guess, some eviction protections, whereas in Santa Cruz...
I don't think anybody from my place will get evicted. They'll get priced out.
Right.
There are all kinds of protections against eviction here.
Right.
On the other hand, that doesn't necessarily protect people.
Can you explain?
Well, if you get protected from eviction, there's no way you could get evicted, and your rent goes up $300, and there's no way you could pay it.
But don't you have some kind of minimal rent control there? When you move out, there's vacancy decontrol because of the state Costa-Hawkins bill. But if you are staying there, isn't there a limit to the amount that can be raised?
Except for the capital.
Of a kind, and those that had rent control at De Anza Mobile Home Park have been essentially sold out in spite of promises by the city council to defend their rent control as part of the agreements they made with the essentially seniors in the mobile home park.
No, that sounds worse than it is here. The city council and the rent board are definitely pro-tenant. It's just that there isn't a hell of a lot they can do.
Yeah, we certainly don't have a pro-tenant city council, and we haven't even got a rent board. And it looks like we're losing the last remnants of the small rent control protections for the limited mobile home park people only in Santa Cruz that went in the early 90s because of the city's willingness to follow the agenda of our city manager for life, Dick Wilson, who essentially is the powerhouse in Santa Cruz.
Ouch.
Yeah. Well, it's always nice to exchange bad news with you, Julia, and good poetry. We're talking with Julia Vinograd of Berkeley. You can catch her book if you want to give her drop her a line and a $5 bill at 1630 University Avenue, number 34, 94703.
Yeah, Berkeley.
In Berkeley, California. And again, I've got it locally if you don't want to go through all that trouble, and I'll pocket the money and head for Venezuela, or possibly drop it off at your place, Julia, when I
need. Oh yeah,
I come to
town. I like
town.
That. I wish somebody could make enough money selling my books to have a fantastic vacation.
Well, you should start writing, for John Kerry's election campaign, perhaps, or maybe Bush's election, or one of those guys. You know, they all look alike to me. What can I say?
Oh, well, I'll vote Democratic. I always do.
Oh dear. Well, we'll have to work on that with you, Julia. Anyway, I want to thank you for being on the show. Anything you want to conclude with?
No, just stay in touch, and good luck to all of us, I guess.
I'll second that.
I have a feeling we're going to need it.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Okay.
Thank you, Julia.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And that was Julia Vinograd of Berkeley. I really like her poetry, and if you do too and you want to get some, give me a call on the Huff line or drop her a line directly. It's worth the money, and she needs the money too. She is negotiating with her landlords even as we speak, more or less. So this is Free Radio. You're tuned to 96.3 FM, 101.1 FM, www.freakradio.org. The call-in number, if you want to join the conversation, is 427-3772. The email, in case you want to email me and let me know what's cooking, is rnorse@hotmail.com. That's rnorse@hotmail.com. And we got about an hour left in the show. And I was going to be reading something about Kerry, but I decided, heck, we're going to hear enough about him, too much about him in the months to come. We need to talk more locally here. I did pick up a copy of today's St. Anal, the local, quote, newspaper. Unfortunately, it looks like I only got one section of it with me. But I do have Friday's paper, which has a front page story, Rent Control Reverberations, Exodus Starts at the Park. And this isn't the place they... The park they're talking about is not the De Anza mobile home, the senior park sold out by the group of seniors at the park itself, who were the kind of the elected, appointed, or I guess they were elected leaders. So they were the group at the center who owned the fanciest homes and then decided that they were, even though they'd gotten the signatures to reverse the Supreme Council, that's the Santa Cruz City Council's throw out rent control sweetheart deal with MHC, that multinational corporation, or certainly it's multinational, but it's a huge national corporation. Even though they'd gotten the referendum signatures in an amazing feat, within 2 or 3 weeks, thanks to these seniors getting out on the streets and getting the signatures of registered voters, they were ready to turn it all around. They bought the fear-mongering tactics of the city council and MHC and held kind of what sounded to me like manipulated, if not rigged, meetings in which critics were kept out. People like former council member Crone, who was actually advocating for the rights of the tenants, was kept out. The lawyer who would have explained the situation and given a very articulate rendition of it to the appropriate mobile home association was excluded. And the people who are at the top of this group rammed through their own agenda, which was a sellout to the city council deal with MHC. And so they now have 1 year to get rid of their trailers, which they can do it at only double the rent, current rent. But after that, if they try to sell their homes in the so-called 34-year lease, which maintains the current rent control situation, but only for the current occupant, the rents will revert to market level, making their homes unsaleable and destroying the equity in their homes completely. And I've yet to hear what's, you know, a real clear refutation of that. I guess there was a couple of people who were skeptical, thinking that this wouldn't affect the equity that much, but actually there was general agreement. This destroyed the value of their homes and destroyed the value of rent control. And was just another, just a very typical example of Rotkin and Kennedy and that gang, including Riley and Porter, these great liberals. Porter, of course, I should exclude him from that because he did vote against it. He was the one council member who voted against it, but it was very, very late in the game when he voted against it. And I believe, in the end, he was advising the... I could be wrong about this, but I believe he was advising tenants to go along with the deal, even though he didn't like the deal the city council had done. And I'm not sure about that, so let's hold off on that. But certainly everybody but Porter on the council on this issue were selling out rent control, the tenants, and essentially by extension, the elderly in Santa Cruz and tenants in Santa Cruz generally. That's really... They said they were doing it to protect the social services and to protect the city budget and all that sort of thing. But in fact, their figures were not terribly persuasive. It sounds like I'm a little bit too low here. I apologize for my having low levels. You can turn down your radio a little bit now if you want. I've raised the level appropriately. It sounds... I'm having a little trouble with my board here. If anybody wants to call in and tell me if I'm blasting them out, please do and let me know. Anyway, the story in the Friday Sentinel talks about a second trailer court that is being sold out, essentially by the same city council, and it essentially is the same deal, the revocation of rent control, the destruction of rent control, this time benefiting Barry Swenson and local moguls, local landlords. We had a long interview with someone from Clearview Court, which is a trailer park right up near what is now the Coast Santa Cruz Hotel. What was it? It wasn't the Holiday Inn. It was the Paradise Inn, the Freedom Inn. What is it? It's on the hill right up from the wharf and the boardwalk as you head out toward, head north in the along the city, along the coast. And it's an interesting article by Heather Berner, who probably gave us more information than we could have otherwise expected on the issue, but eventually didn't really hold the city council to account, or certainly didn't hold the De Anza people to account, the De Anza bosses who sold out the De Anza people generally. But this is an interesting, a lengthy article, a front-page article, which describes some of the situation. And I'm rather than go through it in detail now, I'm going to hope to get a Clearview Court resident on the air
perhaps Deborah Turner, who's mentioned in the paper, to talk about the issue. As I recall, there were some pretty outspoken residents there, more so than at De Anza, who were willing to really kick ass and speak plainly about what was going on. Maybe they'll do the same. I know I talked to the former president of the Clearview Court, and he was kind of hedging his bets and mincing his words and being very careful because of the negotiations that were taking place. But as I suggested at the time, it was all amounting to the same thing. Without getting some steel in your spine and some strength in your arm by getting, like maybe getting circulating signatures for a referendum or some kind of initiative to overturn the city council's rent control nonsense, there would really be little bargaining power, and you would have people essentially being sold out. At Clearview Court, apparently, it involves not just the destruction of rent control, but city, I don't know if it was De Anza, it was city negligence in apparently writing a sloppy law in 1994, Barisoni's sloppy law, John Barisoni, our city attorney, and also the Clearview Court situation, the owners, supposedly, or perhaps the city, or perhaps both of them, didn't properly inform the residents that they had the right to have to be in rent control. And so a bunch of people not in rent control are getting ousted. Heather Berner's article doesn't mention that even the people on rent control will be ousted as well, in the sense that they are facing the same explosion of rents that De Anza is with the destruction of the rent control law. That if they try to sell their home, they're going to be faced with rents moving up to market value, which means no rent control, which means who's going to buy a home when you have to pay a huge amount of money for a space to live there, and then how can you afford to haul your home away? Again, I'll be talking about all this when I've got someone in the studio, or perhaps I'll be playing an interview or having the person on the telephone. So if you're interested in this issue, please give a call to the Huff line, 423-HUFF. If you have some information you want to give, you've got some contacts, I'd love to have some more knowledgeable people talking about this issue on the air next Thursday when I come back, and that'll be Thursday, 6 o'clock in the evening on the show. Some other things, the Fisher App Live, a newspaper I'm not terribly excited about, but I suppose it's nominally more thrilling than the City on a Hill, which I call Kitty on a Hill, or Putty on a Hill, which has, in this last issue, for the last semester, they've included no letters columns, of course, which frustrates occasional letter writers like me, but also shows their lack of interest in any kind of real public input. They just don't care about public input anymore. I don't know whether it's a policy decision to exclude us cranky types from writing in letters. Probably not. Probably has something to do with something else. But maybe I can find out more about that when I come back, another version of the show, in one of these future shows down the road. And I'll make a note of that, and perhaps we can get into that. But the Fisher App Live, the February 11th issue, has an interesting article by Lauren Kennedy. It's an interview with Mayor Scott Kennedy called The Politics of Nothing / Everything. I'm not sure what that means, but my name, of course, this is why it's so interesting, appears in the article, along with sort of a general and series of questions about the city and how the mayor is doing with it, businesses fleeing the city, rent utilities and rent control. Kennedy talks about his mea culpa around the, I don't know if it's even mea culpa. Yeah, he is mea culpa. He says, we were defeated by a major corporation, Mobile Homes Corporation. That's what I was talking about with De Anza. And he also talks about the recent arrests at City Council, and I'm going to be actually hoping not only to discuss this on the air in greater detail, but also to be, she's going to be interviewing me in a response, so hopefully I'll be able to get some equal time on that. Kennedy, just to give people an update on the arrest of City Council in January, Kennedy's, of course, still refused to put the sleeping ban on the agenda or to do anything about the issue in terms of police harassment of homeless people. in terms of complaints under the downtown ordinances. He's taken a pretty strong, what do you say, pro-downtown association position. Everything's okay with these new laws. If people just trust the local police, we're all going to come out fine. There's just a bunch of activists ranting away and so forth. But, of course, as I mentioned earlier in the show, there is not just an issue of human dignity, but also human survival involved. And Kennedy takes the bizarre position that supporting the sleeping ban, the law that criminalizes sleep after 11 o'clock at night in Santa Cruz, is somehow pro-survival because it's not healthy for the homeless or safe for the homeless to sleep outdoors. This is the absurd position that Jane Yokoyama, who was a council member back in the early 90s, took. We called her Jane Hokey Mama. She was a person who took some good positions on the rights of Latinos and immigration harassment raids by the then INS. But on local issues, she had this sort of party line, pseudo-progressive, nonsensical notion that wasn't even a notion. It was, I don't think anybody could seriously maintain this in arguments, but she felt it was politically not feasible to change the camping ordinance or the situation with sleeping at night for homeless people, and therefore she used the argument, which Kennedy is now using, that, oh, it's, you know, we want affordable housing for them. We don't want just campgrounds. Of course, there is no affordable housing for the people who are outside, and there's no campground either. And more important, even not more important, but certainly as important, they aren't even allowed to find legal places themselves to go to crawl into a hole outdoors anyway. That's illegal. So I guess they're saying that these homeless people are so stupid, we're going to force them indoors, you see, because it's for their own good, their own health. I'm not sure what Kennedy is saying. And one of the things Kennedy says in this article is he mentions that he has office hours Monday through Thursday from 2 to 4. So note that, folks. If you want to talk to Mayor Scott Kennedy, supposedly, you can go to his office Monday through Thursday from 2 o'clock to 4 o'clock in the afternoon, according to the Fish Wrap Live. I would call City Council to get confirmation of that, by the way. And the number to call is 420-5020, 420-5020. You can even call today, and you'll get a message machine, but you can leave a message and ask them to reply when in fact, are his office hours and what's the procedure for calling in and getting an appointment. We have a call-in. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Yeah, Robert, what is so damn progressive about letting the homeless trash the woods?
How about the right to sleep at night there?
What is the deal with trashing the woods,
What
Robert?
Is the deal with not being able to sleep at night?
That's not the forest's problem.
I'm asking you, do you favor the right of a homeless person to sleep at night, yes or no, outside somewhere?
I'm asking you, do you favor the right of a homeless to trash the woods, yes or no?
I'll answer your question when you answer mine.
I think the homeless ought to be able to sleep.
All right, then I'll answer your question. I don't think the homeless should trash the woods.
All right, so when are you going to say anything about that?
I just did.
Yeah, well, is that all you have to say about it?
Is that all you have to say about the sleeping situation?
I'm concerned about the forest, Robert.
And I'm concerned about the rights of homeless people
all
to
right,
sleep.
All right, so you get the homeless people to sleep, but not in the forest where they are absolutely irresponsible.
Good, then you find them legal places outside the forest.
No, if they're
going to
sleep in the forest, the least they can do is be responsible.
And I agree
not.
With that. I agree
you
with
don't
that.
Say anything
you
about that
them.
Unless I bring it up, and then
good.
You pay
well,
a
you find
amount
them
of lip service to
Why don't you bring up with your
I'm tired of you worrying yeah. about the rights of the homeless to sleep in the forest. They trash the hell out of the
right.
place, and you never say anything about it unless I bring it up, and then you quickly put a little plug in there.
Why don't you find legal places for them not in the forest, and that would actually help the forest not get trashed?
I think they ought to take the responsibility if they're going to live in the forest, which the forest already has plenty of problems without them. If they're going to be there, they could damn well be responsible at least enough not to further trash the place if they're going to be there.
And you can be responsible in your community, as you are today, for bringing up the fact that people should have legal places to sleep at night in Santa Cruz.
I think these people should be showing some responsibility if they want other people to be concerned for them. And if they don't show enough responsibility not to make a garbage dump out of the forest, it's kind of hard to feel sorry for them, Robert. Mm-hmm.
So when are you going to call the mayor and tell him to set up legal places not in the forest for homeless people to sleep?
When are you going to tell the forest people not to trash the place?
I just
they
did. Answer my question.
Though. They ought to be, they ought to, if they're going to live
did.
In the forest illegally,
answer my question,
they ought caller. To be doing,
caller.
Yeah.
Answer my question. When are you going to call Kennedy and ask him to set up legal places for homeless people to sleep, not in the forest?
When they stop trashing the forest.
So that might be when hell freezes over, you know?
Yeah, well,
sound like you're too
interested. I don't have a lot of compassion for bums. I have compassion for the homeless, but if they're going to be bums, then, you know, the hell with them. Just the hell with them.
Well, that's very enlightened of you, caller.
Yeah, well, it's very enlightened to you to make excuses for bums. And there's a distinction between homeless and bums, and you don't make that distinction.
Mm. Well, I think everyone should have the right to sleep somewhere legally, and
they don't have the right to be bums, Robert.
But I think you do too. But I think when I ask you to call the mayor and say something about it, you apparently don't want to do that. Is that a fair statement?
When's the last time you called the mayor and said something on behalf of the forest?
I haven't talked to the mayor on behalf of the forest, but you apparently haven't talked to the mayor on behalf of this situation either.
So why do I have to take up your cause, Robert?
You know, we both have our respective areas of interest.
Yeah,
actually.
And you get the homeless to sleep wherever you want, but I'm concerned about them making a garbage dump out of the forest.
And one way to avoid that would be to get the mayor to set up a legal campground, wouldn't it?
What you're saying is meet our demands or this forest gets it. That's your attitude.
No, that's not my attitude at all. My attitude is, if you want to do something in a constructive way, then what you need to do, I'm sorry, I had to turn down your sound because I want to finish what I'm saying here, is you should, you know, propose a constructive alternative that would make it less likely that would happen. These moral appeals, it's like telling people, oh gosh, don't go out and have children, you know? And yet at the same time, let's use abstinence and not have birth control devices. I mean, it's foolish. It's counterproductive. It doesn't do any good. You know, it's a Republican agenda. I don't like it. You know, I mean, I think if you want to do something concrete, you should...
You have a Republican agenda. Your attitude is we're taking good care of the forest, so we don't want to hear about the forest problems.
I don't mind
your...
Listen, if you want to talk about the forest problems, that's fine, but please don't scapegoat homeless people and don't try to separate the issues.
No, hey, look, I feel bad for the homeless, they are going to trash the forest, that's where I draw the line.
I think anybody who trashes the forest is performing a disservice, and I think that you can also perform a good service, caller, by contacting politicians and telling them that, yes, I am urging homeless people to not to trash the forest. Yes, I regret the fact that activists like this Norse character doesn't spend enough time educating the homeless about this. But I think you should also be aware that it might take some of the pressure off our forest if there were real legal places for people to go.
I think it would take some pressure off the forest if people behaved responsibly if they're going to intrude into the forest illegally.
Well, illegally or legally, the fact of the matter is that people need places to sleep, and I think that when we find those places, the forest will be better off for it, and we'll all be better off for it.
Robert, I think you are taking the attitude, meet my demands or this forest gets it.
That's not what I'm saying.
Well, in so many words, that's what you're saying.
No, it's not.
Well, if you think about it, it is.
Well, let me think about it.
You might not agree with me, but I'll bet a lot of people would agree with me.
Well, let's see what other people think, and I appreciate your call.
Anything
you want to conclude with?
I like you, Robert. I just wish that you were a little more upfront about forest conservation. And, you know, your attitude is take care of the homeless and the forest will be okay. But that's a very Pollyanna viewpoint because there's lots more homeless than what Santa Cruz can ever hope to take care of. And people need to take personal responsibility. I think everybody can agree that people need to take personal responsibility for their behavior, right?
Well, thank
everybody
you.
Everybody from the far left to the far right should be able to agree we need to take personal responsibility for our behavior.
I agree. Well, listen, thank you for calling. That extends
to the person in the forest illegally.
I got you. Well, listen, I appreciate you letting me know that, and let's see what other people have to say about this. And if you want to give your own thoughts on this or other issues you've heard today, you can give a call. 427-3772 is the number to call in. That's Pat. He's a passionate defender, and properly so, of the environment locally, which, like other things, is threatened. So call in with your thoughts if you'd like. And at the same time, of course, my perspective is we need to be concerned about the human environment, and the human environment has to do with the basic rights that people are being denied here in Santa Cruz, and that have their consequences. And the consequences are, if people have no legal place to go, they go where they can. And if every avenue is illegal in terms of sleeping outdoors or even in your own vehicle, then you're likely to have less respect for the law and perhaps less respect for your surroundings. That's not always true, of course, but could well be true in this case. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hello, Robert.
Hi.
Hi, I just had a little reaction to that. What's that man's name, Pat?
That's Pat, yeah.
Yeah, I'm kind of wondering why he's holding you responsible for education of the homeless people on how they, live in the forest. You would think that he would, look to the city officials, for that. I mean, he can urge you, to tell homeless people around that, and that would be okay, but he's kind of acting like that you're responsible, and I don't think that that's your job, is it?
Well, no, it isn't. It depends. I think that it would be more effective. That's why I suggested he call Kennedy and organize around even his environmental groups to say, look, we could protect the environment better by supporting some environmentally sound, low-income camp areas so that, it would encourage people not to try to go hide up in the Poganip. Although the Poganip is a beautiful place, some people like to be outdoors and so forth, and that happens. And also, I would think that one thing Huff has done is it's proposed what's called an environmentally sensitive set of camper guidelines, which we were working on to some extent with Jon Golder before he was dragged through the courts by the city and essentially spending all his time dealing with community service around that issue and got discouraged from working on the issue that he was working on before. So, it's a real issue. I'm not saying it isn't a real issue. I think, as
it's
I told him...
It's a real issue. I'm just talking about its responsibility.
Oh, responsibility. Well, I mean, I don't think... He thinks if I have influence over a lot of people, I could... That if I somehow, this is a pulpit, stood up and declaimed that, protect the environment, be nice to the environment, don't trash the forest. I mean, what's needed are a specific series of guidelines. I think, in fact, that the city should put out a series of guidelines for responsible camping. But see, it's like they don't want to admit that people
right.
even do that.
That's the contradiction.
Exactly. That's the problem.
Yeah. You're right. That's the contradiction that Pat, for some reason, doesn't want to discuss. I think, though, that, obviously, I think he should go to the environment groups. However, I'm not sure that the environment groups, would fit the ideal, that we want, as being some safe,
I know that when Camp Paradise was on the agenda a couple years ago, there was a lot of hostility, initially at least, from environmentalists of the idea that the riverside was being despoiled by Camp Paradise people. And indeed, there was several legitimate concerns. There was a generator set up and so forth. And the Camp Paradise people said they'd be happy. They were happy trying to move if there were a place they could go to. And in fact, the entire homeless service center would send people to Camp Paradise because they had no legal place to send people to. This was, under the great, Mayor Fitzmaurice at that time, the Green Party guru and all that. But
anyway,
you got to deal with that.
Pat, if you're listening, it would be really nice if you were to call back and respond to me. I have two questions for you. One is, is Robert Norris primarily responsible for the problem? That's number one. And number two, would you be willing, to go to some of the environmental groups and talk about this in a very, very real way?
Well, you can also, of course, get in touch with Pat directly. I mean, I think he's...
No, I want to hear him on the radio, just talking to me privately.
Well, I know you do. I all right, let's see what other people got to think.
Thank you.
Sure.
Bye.
Bye-bye. You're tuned to Free Radio, and this is your opportunity to call in, and here is a call. Hi there.
In response to his question,
sure.
I don't hold you responsible for anybody but yourself.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to assume responsibility for the homeless, then I hold you responsible for them.
I don't. I don't
All
assume
right.
responsibility for anybody else. And I don't think I've ever camped out locally here in the forest myself. And I think I'm pretty responsible.
All right.
Yeah.
At any rate, the forest is not a campground for anybody, regardless of whether they're in having personal problems or not. The forest has its hands full already with all kinds of human-induced problems. Everybody's got their own excuse for why they want to create an additional impact on the forest, whether it's mountain bikers, bums, loggers, rich people wanting to put their damn trophy houses in the forest, you name it. There's always an excuse to make a further intrusion into the forest. The East June Access Road for the campus, all of this, of course, goes back to irresponsible human population growth, which, in my opinion, lies at the core of our problems. I mean, it's kind of hard to argue that this planet can handle 6,333 million people with approximately another Santa Cruz County full of humans added to it every single day. There's a little detail people don't even want to touch on as they argue about their endlessly increasing neediness. But just discussing the local forests, the places are being horribly impacted by all kinds of things, invasive exotic plants, among other things. I have my hands full dealing with that kind of stuff.
Sure.
I don't really have the time to go to environmental groups and argue that we should have additional impacts from homeless people, okay? I mean, whether they're bums or whether they're just homeless people trying to minimize their impact, which in my experience in the forest, and I've got quite a bit of experience in the forest, I know a couple people who are homeless scampers who behave responsibly,
yeah,
and they are the exception, I promise you.
Well, you know, Pat, I don't think the caller was suggesting, the previous caller was suggesting suggest the forest should be a refuge or should suffer further impacts from homeless people or anybody else. He was suggesting that one way to avoid the forest suffering would be to encourage the city council to find other solutions that might take the pressure off the forest.
But you're talking about campgrounds. I mean, where would these campgrounds go but the forest?
Well, there are things like, for example, parking areas for people in their vehicles to park.
All right, once that gets maxed out, then what?
Well, before it gets maxed out, you would have at least some diminution of people who would, I would think, be using, you know, the forest areas.
Yeah, but let's think this through. I mean, if Santa Cruz did everything you wanted, you argue that that would not create a magnet effect, but...
I do.
You take quite the opposite view towards widening Highway 17... in which you argue that that would be a magnet
effect.
Actually,
I don't take strong positions on the either the widening or the non-widening.
Well, I've heard you discuss that, Robert. You argued against widening Highway 17 because it would make it easier for people in Silicon Valley to live in Santa Cruz, and it would.
You may have heard
first, it would take pressure off. This is the way widening highways work. At first, it looks like there's lots more space.
No, I'm familiar with the
that
argument.
That encourages people
Pat, I'm
to
familiar
live
with
further
the argument.
Away from where they work, and before you know it, you're right back where
Pat,
you started
I'm
from.
I'm familiar with the argument, but I have not been a strong proponent either way, as I recall. But I mean, I probably do tend in that direction, but. My view about homeless people and their nomadic so transient folks stems from talking to people in social services in different communities that have lifted sleeping bans, and they say there's no increase in social services use. And we're talking Eugene, we're talking Miami.
Aren't you arguing to make Santa Cruz more attractive for homeless people? I mean, if you make it more pleasant.
No, more survivable, not more attractive. I mean, there's a difference.
By definition, more survivable is more attractive.
Well, let's put it this way. I don't think human rights violations.
Let's not quibble here, Robert.
I don't think human rights violations are appropriate anywhere in this country. And insofar as eliminating them makes it more attractive, yes. On the other hand, I'm not talking about putting out tinsel and offering rewards to come to Santa Cruz of some sort that would actually meaningfully attract people, like, let's say, jobs and housing. That would attract people.
Yeah, well, jobs and housing are part of what homeless people require, right?
They do,
okay,
but I'm not saying that.
That's the next step. Once you've got church parking lots filled up with homeless campers, Then you've got to get jobs for them. Then you've got to get more permanent housing for them. Then you've got to have health care for them. Then you've got to provide education for their children. Then you've got to have an infrastructure for all that, which other homeless people around the country, they say, hey, man, Santa Cruz, that's the place to be. Great climate year-round. They treat you good. And that's human nature. I'm not saying that, that's evil. It's just the way things are, Robert. So in the real world, one medium-sized town can only do so much, especially when people don't want to just write blank checks for everything you would like to have done for homeless people.
Okay, there are two issues here. One is social services, and the other has to do with basic human rights, as far as I'm concerned. I guess if you want to provide, you're right. You know, I mean, eventually you would want those kinds of services, and not just here, everywhere in the country, obviously, for people, because it's an essential part of a civilized society. But my main advocacy here is, given the circumstances we're in, you do not arrest and criminalize people for sleeping and for doing what they need to do. And I think you probably agree with me on some level on this, I think.
I do agree.
Yeah.
I do agree. But ultimately, we can't just put Band-Aids on this problem without having other problems pop up. And I think we understand that. I mean, because all these things come up in context. And if you try to isolate one problem and just fix that, then you've got other problems popping up. If you try, for example, to avoid providing more cheap housing, then you've got a problem with that. If you do provide the more cheap housing, then you encourage people to move to Santa Cruz, and that is a fact. I mean, you make a place more attractive, you're going to attract more people by definition. So it's a dilemma. You either have to just draw the line, which isn't going to be a pleasant line to draw, or you just simply say, all right, here it is, come and get it. And, you know, we're going to just be one. I mean, the coasts are very attractive. People want to live near water, and that's a very basic thing. That's why most of the population centers on the planet are near water. So that means that I think we ought to be talking about the size of the human population based on where people want to live. Okay, they don't want to live in Siberia. They don't want to live in North Dakota. They want to live in Santa Cruz. So we need a population for the world that is scaled to the idea that people are going to want to live in certain places, and those certain places should not be megapolises like Los Angeles, for example, which, you know, kind of runs from Santa Barbara down to somewhere in Mexico at this point. Now, that's the big picture.
Right,
now, when you start looking down at little pictures, we talk about the rights of homeless people to camp in Santa Cruz. And I understand you got to deal with both aspects of a problem. You got to deal with the big picture and the little picture. I always catch flack because I want to, you know, put more attention on the big picture. But the big picture ultimately needs to be dealt with, or else we're just going to find that the little picture gets ever more and more and more undoable. And you're finding that out, Robert. How much success have you had with...
Wait a minute.
Let me ask you a question.
Wait. Before you ask me a question, I want to ask you a question. because you presented your case pretty eloquently and laid it out. What about that little picture? What about tonight? Now, you do acknowledge that people need some place legally to sleep, or at least, let's say, if they find it, they should be. Let's start with this. Should people be allowed to sleep in a vehicle that is legally parked in Santa Cruz?
Up to a point. I mean, I got a ticket for sleeping in a vehicle myself, and the judge let me off with the understanding that if I ever got caught again, the fine would be three times what the suspended fine was, and I agreed to that.
When was this, buddy?
That was, a good 10 years ago.
Uh-huh.
So I understand that stuff. But I also understand that the world's really overpopulated, and so I spent a lot of time trying to put get people to contend with that realistically rather than just shrug your shoulders and go, oh, that's unrealistic. We can't be bothered with that. That's silly. That's undoable.
We know it's unethical. It's not silly. It's not silly. But what I try to do, however, on this show, as you know, is I try to relate this to the particular issues that my listeners, I think, are interested in, too, and frankly, that I'm interested in. So I appreciate your kind of...
Yeah, the long-range solution to these things, though, has to come in the context of human carrying capacity. The planet is crammed to the brim with people.
Well, you talked about your ticket, but what about... You didn't really answer my question. My question was, what about the people tonight? You said to a point. People should be allowed to sleep in there. What point is that?
Well, the point is that if Santa Cruz becomes ever more attractive to homeless people, it's going to attract ever more homeless people, and we're going to have a bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger city.
So I know that's the magnet argument. And you don't obviously agree with my assessment that that's not the case.
And I don't think you've discredited why I disagree with you, because you make a place more attractive, you're going to attract more people.
I have pointed out to you that when sleeping bans are lifted in at least two other areas,
What are those areas?
Eugene and Miami, Florida.
All right. And they maintain that did not attract more homeless people.
That's what the social service people there say.
All right. So
they could not be telling me the truth. I could have inadequate statistics, but that is what I have heard from, and again, my...
What if we determined that there was X number of homeless people in Santa Cruz County, and we took care of it, and let's say your whole wish list was fulfilled until even you no longer complained about not enough being done.
Me no longer complain? Are you kidding? Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. No. Just bear with me here, Robert.
All right.
Imagine your wish list was fulfilled to the point where you no longer had a single complaint about what the city was doing for the homeless.
Mm-hmm.
We established that there was X number of people in Santa Cruz County that are homeless. We established that there was no magnet effect by providing this entire wish list of social services for homeless people.
Right now, though, we're just talking about the right to sleep, right?
Well,
sleep in your own vehicle.
All right, you got the right to sleep, then you're going to go down to the next thing on the wish list, right? Or is the right to sleep your whole point here? Is that all you're asking for the homeless?
Well,
no.
No, it's not all
right.
I'm asking, but it's...
Let's assume, Robert, that everything you want done for the homeless is done.
Mm-hmm.
And everything that the homeless, you know, every individual homeless person wants, the whole wish list is fulfilled for the X number of homeless people we have determined that exist in Santa Cruz County. We've also established that there's no magnet effect, so that number X will always be X. It's not going to start multiplying. So what happens if X number of people are all taken care of, but now we've got more people beyond X? Do we just tell them, sorry, since the magnet effect doesn't apply, that means that you people don't exist? Do you understand what I'm saying?
No, I do understand what you're saying.
All right.
It,
so
it's
are you willing to say that we'll do so much for X number of people and beyond that, it's not our problem because the magnet effect is not recognized?
In terms of positive social services, I would say yes. In terms of... preventing a person, let's say, from sleeping in their own vehicle or sleeping in an area where they're not bothering anybody else because they have to and they have no other alternatives, I would say no.
So, but it never ends with that. I mean, if you're going to sleep in your vehicle, then you're going to need a place to pee. If you don't have a place to pee, you're going to pee in the local bushes. The neighbors aren't going to like it. Then the next problem is going to be litter or loud music or drugs or something else. And the neighbors aren't going to like it. And we've been through this countless times. It's not just simply sleeping in your vehicle, end of problem. There's always, where am I going to pee? And, you know, are you going to provide a porta potty?
There are some minimal things like public facilities that need to be...
Right. And once those minimal things are done, then you move to the next thing.
Well, let's put it this way. I mean, I don't see, you're saying that, should we say, okay, only 50 people a day are going to be allowed to use this particular restroom. If the 51st person comes, you can't do it. Now, that doesn't happen, you know. That isn't, I mean, obviously there are circumstances where facilities are badly overburdened under some circumstances, and that's the paranoia fantasy that you hear cities constantly rousing when you talk about decriminalizing basic human functions for homeless people. Everybody in the world is going to come, and it's going to result in huge overflow, this and that. But you know, I guess what Mike Schmidt said, who was doing some work on this issue several years ago, and who was very conservative in some ways, and in other ways he was very outspoken about at least dealing with things like the sleeping ban. He felt that the most important thing is to deal with local homeless people, of which there is a considerable number. And that after that, no, you're less concerned, and there is a cutoff line. And I'm sympathetic to that argument. I don't want to give a hard and fast rule here, but I mean,
yeah. But the hard and fast rules are what politicians have to come up with, and then it's easy to take pot shots at them.
They can come up.
They do have to come up.
Right. They can come up with a hard and fast rule, and I think that would remove most of the steam from anything I'm saying. I mean, I can ask for more after that, but that's fine. I can be ignored in that respect if what I'm saying is, you know, too demanding or irrational.
I think you are somewhat ignored now.
So it is. But I don't think that's not because what I'm saying is irrational, nor because it's unreasonable, because I think you agree with my position on this issue that
people need to sleep. That's obvious. People need to sleep. It's also obvious that if one particular locale becomes very accommodating to the needs of homeless people, it is going to attract other homeless people. That is just so fundamentally basic. It's really hard to argue against it.
It sounds reasonable, but it's just not, empirically, it's not been the case.
Well, let me give you an example, Robert.
Yeah.
Is Santa Cruz, however much you badmouth Santa Cruz, is Santa Cruz perceived by most of the country to be on the far left politically?
You know, I don't know, but I know certainly some of the media says that. Yeah. I think most people in this country haven't heard of Santa Cruz. I don't know where the hell it is. And if they get their information from the mainstream media, maybe they think that. You there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, I mean, that's just my offhand reaction to that. You know, there was a time, for example, when a lot of people did flow in, homeless people did flow into Santa Cruz, and when the campground was opened in 1995, I'm going to be giving you arguments that may seem to be contrary and supportive of your thoughts and your common sense argument that more even a legal place to sleep provides, you know, a magnet. That's your claim, I believe.
It is. The point I was making with this thing about politics, the left traditionally is perceived as being more concerned about the rights of the downtrodden than the right. Is that right? In other words,
yeah,
whatever you have to say about the Santa Cruz City